Struggling to move your nonprofit forward? You've come to the right place. Welcome to the Nonprofit Architect, where we are giving you the actionable steps you need to launch and grow your nonprofit organization. Now, here's your host, Travis Johnson.
Hey, welcome back to the show. I'm here with Ron Kamen. Ron, how are you today?
Doing great, Travis. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Yeah, glad to have you. Ron is the founder and principal of Earthkind Energy Consulting, deals with clean energy, down with dirty energy, up with clean energy, and you've got a lot of different solutions out there for the nonprofit world, help save them some money while being earth friendly. Tell us a little bit about how and why you got into this business.
It's been a long ride. You know, I've been doing this almost four decades, so it's been quite the experience. And actually, let me think about how did I start getting into it? You know, because I went to college for accounting and management because I liked, I was good with numbers. I liked the balancing, the debits and the credits, kind of balancing and stuff. And did a graduate in system science, and we could talk about that some other point. But round about that time, I was the last generation at that point that had to register for the draft when there was still a draft. And then there was no draft for a while, and there was no registration for a while. And while I was finishing up my undergraduate and starting my graduate work, there was this little event going on over in the Middle East, one of the other wars that started. And at that point, it was actually Iran before Iraq and all the rest of it. And I had four younger brothers. And all of a sudden, they had to register for this draft. And I was starting to scratch my head and say, wait a second. Where are they going to go? And what are they going to be fighting for? And they didn't seem to be about defending democracy. It seemed to be about grabbing that oil and that energy stuff. And that kind of opened up a crack in my brain. And I started finding out more and more about energy. And not too long after that, I was lucky enough to get took a cut in pay to take a job working as a community organizer, helping to serve the public. And the issue was energy. And at that point, it was the phasing in of the nuclear power plants that when they started, were going to create energy too cheap to meter, if you can believe such a thing. I mean, I actually was a big supporter of nuclear power growing up. I was a big sci-fi fan. I felt like the nukes were going to take us to the stars. Then I worked at the Shoreham Nuclear Power Plant and have a whole little insight into how that all didn't work too well. But then when I started my organizing career, energy prices were going up 25%, 18% year after year. I started working with people on fixed incomes who literally were shutting down their homes because they couldn't afford to heat and eat. It was a choice between one or the other. And realize that, you know what, energy makes the world go round. It's everything that we do. It's civilization as we know it. It's everything from turning the lights on and heating and cooling our buildings, keeping ourselves comfortable and safe, to moving ourselves around and transportation. And energy is at the key of it. And I realized that energy and energy, the environment, was my mission. And I started working on energy and environmental issues, first as a policy guy, looking at different policies that could help make things work. And then after a period of time, set up a nonprofit to take the message out that clean energy was a way for people to save money as well as have a positive environmental impact. And eventually spun that off into a for-profit for a bunch of different reasons and had my consulting practice now for, I guess, 22 years, actually. So it's been quite the ride and an interesting experience. But yeah, energy central to everything we do in civilization. And you got to get energy from somewhere. And, you know, and you got to use it as efficiently as possible, because who can afford to just keep paying these high prices, right? So,
yeah, I fully agree. When you can have a win-win situation that you can save money and save the environment at the same time, that's kind of what grabs my eye. I don't know if I'm like every other person out there, but I'm kind of lazy. And unless it's delivered to me in an easy to use, whatever it is, like, I ain't got the time. I've got so many other things, running the family, doing the career, trying to get podcasting off the ground and everything else we have to do. And they're like, well, we need to do this. I'm like, I'm not one of those early adopters. Like when iPhones came out, like, not interested. You guys go through all the pain. And then when it's economical for me and it makes sense, I'll hop on, but not till that point. Right. So I'm glad that there's people like yourself that really take the leading edge in some of these industries and the way we're changing. as people to take and lead the way on that stuff. That's I've never been that kind of guy. I'm definitely an out of the box thinker, but I'm not an early adopter.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously most people aren't. There are just a few percentage that, you know, help lead the way with things. And, you know, thankfully they do. But the great part about clean energy from my perspective now is as I've watched it evolve is that, you know, it's becoming kind of embedded in a lot of different things and you don't really think about it so much. But for instance, you know, the computers that we're using right now, a lot more energy efficient than they ever were, which is why, you know, the batteries in our smartphones last us a heck of a lot longer than they used to. And the batteries in our laptops and the energy that we're using is so much, we're using it much more efficiently. And by doing it more efficiently, we're actually reducing energy consumption. And as a guy named Amory Lovins out of Colorado once said, the cheapest form of energy is the energy you don't use, right? So when you become more efficient, and for instance, you know, I started out when I started doing energy projects with light bulbs. And why? Well, because it was easy to explain to somebody that, you know, when you have a 100-watt light bulb, right, and you go and you touch a light bulb after it's been on, a 100-watt light bulb, and you burn your hands. That's because 90% of the energy in those incandescent light bulbs is producing heat and not light. So when you get to more advanced technologies, first fluorescence and now light-emitting diodes or LEDs, now with LED lights, the energy, most of it creates visible light and just a little bit of heat. So most of the energy now is creating the light that we are using it for, and it's more efficient. Instead of 100 watts, we can now get the same amount of light for less than 20 watts. So you're down like 80-90%, but still getting the same quality of lighting and same quality of products. And that's happening across the board efficiency-wise. And then it's also happening in an incredible way on the generation side, and we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I got to be honest, I was reluctant to bring you on. I was looking at your bio and stuff. I'm like, this is going to be a pitch fest. It's like, where's going to be the value in this stuff? And then we started chatting and I couldn't help but hit the record button. It seems that there's a lot of ways. I know nonprofits struggle, you know, keeping the lights on because of money flow, for cash flow, for fundraising, for all these reasons. So why not have you want to talk about how they can meet their energy needs and also save money at the same time? What does something like that look like? What have you seen with the other nonprofits you've worked with?
Yes, I worked with a lot of nonprofits over the years, everything from church and religious-based ones through educational organizations, schools, high schools, colleges, K through 12, all different kinds of nonprofits. And, you know, basically the first question is, you know, how much are you spending for what with energy? And most people are pretty familiar. Hey, you know, I got an electricity bill. Okay, that's part of it. I got electricity. Oh, I got a heating bill. Okay, that's another part of it. Heating, hot water. You got a multifamily building, affordable housing complex, nonprofits. I work with affordable housing organizations. Key component is that energy piece because it's very variable and it has major impact on people's budgets. And then also how you're getting around, right? How are your people moving from here to there? What's that cost you in fuel? And now with gas prices doing everything, people are much more aware of the fact that a lot of their budgets are getting eaten up by gasoline or diesel or whatever they're using for transportation. So the first question is, how much are you spending on energy? And when you look at energy, it's not just electricity. It's electricity, it's heating, cooling, hot water, and then it's transportation. So the first thing is, how much money are you spending? First goal. Second thing is, okay, great. So how efficient are you in using that energy? How old are your systems? Do you have, for instance, in lighting, do you still have incandescent light bulbs or old fluorescent light bulbs? Can you change those out to a more efficient technology, reduce your energy consumption, reduce your cost, reduce your labor, because the LED light bulbs last like 10 times longer than an incandescent, so you don't have to change them as often. And is what sort of payback do you get on those efficiency measures? So the first wave is always take a look at what you're doing, how much you're spending, where your pain points are, and then what can you do to hit those with efficiency technologies, first of all, so reduce your energy consumption without compromising your mission or your quality of life. And so you look at electricity and what are you doing there? Are there sensors, for instance, on your lighting equipment? When if you have big spaces and everything's lit 24/7, that's obviously not good. Are people turning off lights? Is that the culture? First of all, what sort of technology is in there that you can switch out that makes it a no-brainer so you don't even have to change the culture? You can just change technology. That's sometimes easier. And then look at your heating and cooling systems. And similarly, you know, depending upon your building infrastructure, heating and cooling could be, in hot water, could be a significant chunk of your budget. And if you're doing a housing complex, obviously your heating, cooling, and hot water is a much bigger thing than in a commercial space if you're just a commercial building. But in all your buildings, you got heating, cooling, and some amount of hot water. That is also a cost, and there's things you can do in the efficiency technologies there. And then similarly with your vehicles, right? I mean, you know, it used to be when, you know, I was growing up, you know, 20 miles to the gallon was pretty good, you know? And, you know, still today there are vehicles that don't even get 20 miles to the gallon. But, you know, can you switch to something that on the, if you're still going to use fossil fuels, at least uses it more efficiently, do things like tune-ups, change filters, both on vehicles and then as well on your heating and air conditioning system. So some things you can do is first take a look at where your dollars are being spent, what your pain points are, how can you address those systematically to make yourself more efficient, use less, save more. And then you can get into looking at different technologies that now take you to the next level.
So before we jump into that, you talked about a lot of stuff. So we got to give a chance to get some back and forth here, right? So I remember the Navy, it was like 2000, I want to say about 2008. I'm sure it's not the right exact year, but they went to every space in the military has light sensors for just that specific reason. They looked at their energy costs. If you look at the Navy as a, you know, if you get rid of the military fighting wars, you turn into just like a company. Navy's an enormous company, right? An enormous company. They got ships, they got planes, subs, they got absolutely ridiculous amount of equipment, buildings, everything else. They've all going to be heat and cooled. And in 2008, sticking with it, stay in 2008, they went to all of these light sensors in the rooms to turn on and off lights. And I don't remember the numbers, but I know the projected numbers were just massive amount of savings, obviously across a huge swath of everything that they do, and converted that, made the change, decided to go with, and saved millions upon millions of dollars by switching that. I don't know if your company or your nonprofit will or will not save $1 million. I have no idea, but they saved an enormous amounts of money by switching to those light centers. They did the analysis. They went through, made the decision. Yes, there's upfront costs of switching over some of these things, but the long-term benefits. Nonprofits get me sometimes. They're like, well, do you know how much that stuff costs? Well, do you plan on shutting down your business next year? Or do you plan on having the nonprofit up and running for the next 20, 30, 50 years? Do you plan on handing it up? You know, the cost that you incur now that maybe you have a little bit of savings over time, that savings adds up greatly every year that you're still in operation. So looking at what changes you might be able to implement and how that might affect you long term, not just in the short term, but long term, you can really make some big strides with small changes. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And the thing is that you can do it in a bunch of ways, right? So one way to do it is just every time you're getting some new light bulb or whatever it is that you're replacing anyway, now just take that incremental step up to get something more efficient, right? So that's one way to do it. Another way is to do it all at once, right? And there's always a payback with that because efficiency pays for itself in some period of time. There's often incentives that you can get from the utility or from the state government, or there's federal incentives. So take a look at those incentives. But then if you don't have the capital, there's third parties that often will put up the entire capital cost, and then you just pay them back out of the savings. And those energy saving performance contracts where you're paying somebody based upon the performance of them actually delivering that energy savings can be another way that you can do that in a way that doesn't impact your capital budget. So you don't have to worry about coming up with the cash up front. You're just going to take it out of the savings from your operational budget later, which is a great way to do it as well. And I've done a lot of projects that way with nonprofits over the years, especially nonprofits and government entities. And that goes true not just for efficiency, but then when you take a look at, for instance, solar electricity has a similar model with something called a power purchase agreement. and I have nonprofits that I've negotiated and worked with that negotiated for and worked with where we put out a bid to for-profit companies. They take those tax benefits that the nonprofits can't access because they don't pay taxes, right? Then the for-profits will take the tax benefits and then deliver electricity at a price that's lower than the utility and save the nonprofit money from day one, but they don't put in any capital costs. A third party puts that in, takes the tax benefits, and then they own and maintain that equipment. So the nonprofit doesn't even have to own and maintain the equipment. They just get the energy savings with a power purchase agreement. So a bunch of different ways of making stuff happen, whether you have the capital, don't have the capital. A lot of times, if you do have some capital, it does make a lot of economic sense to just invest it into your physical plant and do the things like the Navy did with occupancy sensors. They've also done similar things with LEDs, light emitting diodes. Also done stuff. I actually did LED lighting on a hospital ship for the Military Sealift Command, one of my first efficiencies projects, because those little lights on the indicator boards would keep burning out, those little indicator lights. So not only were they inefficient, but they kept burning out and they were a pain because people wouldn't know, is it the lights out? Is it that we have a problem? We don't have a problem. But the LEDs last so much longer now, and it made so much sense economically that it was a great thing to do. So yes, indeed.
So what are some of the upcoming technologies or something that's maybe been around a couple of years that's finally gaining traction? And Matt, I know like podcasting, we're still kind of on the leading edge of podcasting. Not everyone's familiar with it. Not everyone's, but what is in the energy world right now that maybe has been around, but not everyone's adopted it yet? What are some of those things that already exist that more and more companies, more and more nonprofits are like implementing with what they're doing?
Yeah. So there's really three, again, different energy sources, different technologies, right? Some similarities, but just to take it apart. Electricity, solar, right? Solar prices have come down over 99% since solar first came out. Solar across the planet is now the cheapest source of new energy generation compared to anything. It blows out every source. It even blows out existing power plants because prices have come down. Solid state technology. And now the cost is so tremendously lower that it makes sense almost anywhere you are. Some places still have really cheap electricity. It's hard to get those numbers to work, but almost anywhere you can see solar systems going up. Big ones like out in the Midwest and elsewhere, huge solar fields, but then even down to smaller ones, everything from the residents. People have probably seen them on people's homes, and then nonprofits including them either on top of the roofs of their buildings or over their parking lots. Or I have one nonprofit that had a shallow field that they had dumped some, when they had cleared out their soccer field, they had this area that they had just dumped everything on. They weren't using it. It was just sitting there. And that 3 acres supplied 100% of their electricity needs with solar. And they did it without laying out a dime by having a third party come in, put up the capital, and they just saved money from day one. And that savings is actually paying for an extra teacher for that particular nonprofit. So a lot of ways, solar in particular, worth taking a look at out there. Same with LED lighting. If you haven't done LED lighting and/or occupancy sensors in your building, you should really take a look at it because the savings are dramatic, very impactful on the electricity side. Now let's get into the heating and cooling side, which is an interesting thing. So, you know, we're all familiar with air conditioners, right? And air conditioners have gotten much more efficient than they ever were. But an air conditioner is actually a heat pump. And what is a heat pump? Well, a heat pump is an air conditioner. It compresses and expands a gas and then takes heat out of one space and dumps it outside in another space. Our refrigerator and freezers are heat pumps. Similar thing, compression, expansion, take the heat out of the box, dump it at those little coils out the back. So heat pumps have come a long way. And it used to be that heat pumps were most effective down in the South, and the heat pump is in air conditioner or a refrigerator or a freezer, but the other heat pump that takes it in the air is an air source heat pump, which is an air conditioner that cools your building during the summer, but during the winter takes heat out of the air, compresses and expands this gas, and then dumps that heat into your building. So it actually heats your building. Used to be that the technology only was good down to freezing or a little bit below. Now the technology with air source heat pumps has gotten so good that even down to minus 15 degrees, you can have an air source heat pump, a cold climate air source heat pump, providing heat either as a basic heat source or as a supplemental heat source down to minus 15 from the air. So that's an air source heat pump.
Are you talking about Freon units, or are you talking about something else?
Yeah, they're not Freon, but they're like Freon, right? So it's compression, expansion, various different gases. There's an evolution going on in terms of those types of gases, refrigeration gases, and which one you use, which one impacts the ozone and don't. They're evolving from different levels. So there's a bunch of different ones that are out there in terms of refrigerants worth taking a look at. And, you know, how much refrigerant you're going to use and what the impact of that is. But air source heat pumps, to give you a sense, when you have a fossil fuel and you're burning gas or oil or any fossil fuel to create heat, it's always less than 100% efficient. Even the most efficient natural gas boiler is 99% efficient, let's say, but there's always some percent that's just going up the stack. When you have an oil-fired heater, it's much less efficient, can go down to 80%. And then sometimes you have an oil-fired hot water burner that comes off the main furnace, right? And when the furnace is shut off during the summer or spring and fall, and it's just doing the hot water, those efficiencies can be as low as 30 or 40%, which means that two-thirds of your oil budget is just going up the stack as basically just waste heat, right? Any fossil fuel is always less than 100% efficient.
So you want to throw away money, or you want to throw away money. You either have a teenage daughter and you're just throwing money out the window, or you have these old heating units and you're just throwing it outside.
Just throw it in the chimney, burn it up, you know, who needs it, right? So, yeah, exactly. With an air source heat pump, because you're taking that heat out of the air, right, that whatever latent heat is still there, even down to minus 15 or lower, there's still heat in the air, otherwise we wouldn't survive, right? Because you're taking that heat out of the air, you're putting electricity into this heat pump, but every unit of electricity you're putting in to the heat pump, you're getting 2 to 3 units of heating and cooling out of it. So where fossil fuels are less than 100% efficient, air source heat pumps are 250% efficient. Every unit you put in, you get 2 or 3 out because you're using that latent energy that's in the air. The next level, which is the level of heating and cooling, uses that heat beneath our feet, which actually comes out of there's a bunch of different companies, but one of them is Climate Master out there in Oklahoma City, not too far from you, Travis, where in 1957, when the whole world was looking up at Sputnik, they were looking down at the ground and realizing that energy in the ground for billions of years, the Earth has been absorbing half the energy from the sun, and it's lit right down there in that Earth. So that's why when you dig down below the frost line, 4 or 5 feet, most part of the country, you get this constant temperature. Most parts of the country, it's about 50 degrees, can be a little bit higher or lower, depending upon where you are. But you go down into below the frost line, you wind up with this constant temperature. So with geothermal heating and cooling, what you do is you put a fluid, water, down into a pipe. And now it's a closed loop. So basically it just goes down into a pipe, comes back up. You put it in a field, you can put it in a pond, or you can just drill straight down. And by putting that pipe out there under the frost line, you send the water out. The water comes back. It's a constant 50 degrees temperature. Now you use that 50 degrees to either cool your building. You don't need much more to cool a building if you're starting with 50 degrees temperature. And you also use it to heat and cool, to use a heat pump. But now instead of whatever the ambient temperature is outside, instead of 100 degrees, 90 degrees, whatever on the hot days or down in the minuses on the cold days, you got this constant 50 degrees temperature that you're starting with. And so now you have efficiencies of 400 and 500%. Every unit of electricity you put in, you're getting 400 to 500% energy efficiency coming out by using that heat beneath our feet with geothermal heating and cooling, geothermal heat pumps, which is different from geothermal electricity, by the way, but that's a different conversation for another day. So on the heating and cooling side, go from fossil fuels, go to air source heat pumps, which helps you provide air heating and cooling with using the ambient temperature of the air, increase your efficiency to 250% plus or minus. And then if you really want to go to the next round, which a lot of schools, nonprofits, and others are doing, especially with new construction, sometimes it even makes economic sense with retrofits, but definitely new construction is a no-brainer. Use the heat beneath your feet, put in geothermal wells, either in fields or in a pond or right underneath your building. And just to give you a sense, with doing holes in your under your building, going down just 500 feet, which is most part of the country, that's the easiest non-permittable. You don't need extra permits to just drill a hole down 500 feet and do a closed loop geothermal well, send the water down, bring it back up. And under the footprint of a building, you can carry the heating, cooling and hot water load up to 25 stories. It's happening even as far north as Toronto. It's happening all across the country. Heat, cool, hot water, all from the heat beneath our feet, just drilling underneath the footprint of any new building. And obviously, if you don't have a new building, you've got an existing building. There's other ways of doing retrofits, and that's a little bit longer timeline for your recovery of your asset and your investment, but still usually has a payback, especially with different incentives out there. Electricity, solar, first thing. Actually, efficiency, always look at efficiency first. Next wave on electricity generation, look at solar, wherever you put it, on your roof, carport, in a field. Then look at your heating and cooling loads with air source heat pumps, ground source heat pumps. If you have a central air conditioner and it's getting older, don't think about putting in another central air conditioner. At least swap it out for an air source heat pump and get supplemental heat, if not all your heat, from that same unit, and do so more efficiently. And then ground source heat pumps and geothermal being the most efficient there. Now, let's take a look at transportation just for a second. And if you want to get to the next level of nonprofits who do a lot of home deliveries and other ways of driving around or transporting people around and everything else, right? So the fascinating thing about this is that electric vehicles have now really taken off, right? And you're just seeing this exponential growth every year in these technologies. It used to be Tesla definitely was leading the way. There's no doubt. Everybody knows Tesla's story. Great story. Did a wonderful thing. Helped build the market. But every manufacturer now, actually auto manufacturer, has an electric vehicle. No matter what brand you like, what manufacturer you're most exposed to and the light in, you can find an electric vehicle that they're making or soon will be making. So what we've seen is exponential growth in the electric vehicle markets, not the least of which is now being driven by the fact that gasoline is so expensive. And when you compare the cost per mile of gasoline to the cost per mile with electricity, even in the most expensive electricity utility territories in the country, Con Edison, Hawaii, elsewise, you're still looking at a comparable cost of less than or about a dollar a gallon, right? So think about that. Think about what you're paying for gasoline today. Compare that, if you were paying a dollar a gallon, what you would save in terms of dollars in your fuel cost. And then realize that in addition to fuel, you're also saving on maintenance because you don't have any oil changes. You don't have any transmission fluids. You got 20 moving parts instead of 2,000 to break down. And now you take a look at your total cost of ownership with an electric vehicle and it's like, wow, huh. And oh, the costs are coming down. And oh, there's incentives out there. And with the new federal legislation that just got passed, there's going to be even more incentives for nonprofits out there. And there's ways of taking advantage of various different things. So fuel cost, another way to save money with clean energy technology.
I tell you, it's getting crazy with all the different new electric car companies that are just on their own. Some of the big car companies are getting into a little bit of the fun. I don't know if you saw this, Julia Louis-Dreyfus from, Seinfeld. She does a commercial for the Mercedes AA class. And it's a spoof. It's a spoof, but it's hilarious.
Like, that was hilarious.
If you all haven't seen this and you want a good chuckle, a good old fashioned clean humor, not like the other show that I'm producing, which is definitely not clean humor. I have a show. She lifts up the hood and there's something like 9,648 AA batteries. It's the AA class. It's like when they put this thing together, it's like very Mercedes. It's like very well done, very classy. And you have your onboard system that tells you how to replace your batteries. And you hit the button and like 270 things light up for like AAs that need replacing. And if you want to do it all at once, there's an eject button. And there's like 9,000 batteries being ejected out of this car. It's hilarious. The AA class.
Absolutely.
It's all in good fun. Of course, but I am not an early adopter. So
So here you go. So let me just say, I know you're not an early adopter. So let's go with, let's say, a Ford, right? I mean, I wouldn't say that Ford is kind of an early adopter type of manufacturer, right?
Not anymore.
You know, they came out with the Model T. So that was one of the first, right? So, but Ford, has the Ford Mustang E, which is a very cool vehicle if you've ever seen it and known it. And actually, you can even get it with different sounds so that you can make that vroom vroom sound, which was what a lot of Mustang drivers wanted to have. But now it's all electric, right? Which is incredible. But the thing I think that's almost most exciting about Ford these days is the F-150, which is the best selling truck in the whole country, right? And they now have an F-150 Lightning, which is all electric, right?
I got to ride in it.
Oh, you got to ride in it?
Yeah.
Yeah. How was it?
They commandeered this tiny parking lot. They took you through a little of the experience. They turn on this thing and then they back you up to the wall and give you like the launch. I love driving cars. I love being on the road. And like when I had hot rods and stuff back, they like the launch is what really gets you. And with all the torque, I mean, you can launch those suckers until it feels like you're going to rip the drivetrain apart. I love the feeling of that. It was pretty exciting, but I am a huge road trip guy and I travel, you know, 900 miles in a day. I can't yet do that on electric.
Yeah, that's the part where the technology is evolving, right? So here's a couple things. So a guy like you, it's going to be tough. You got to make sure you plan out your trip well and understand where you're going to get those chargers from. And, you know, the good part about the charging technologies is evolving, right? Tesla, again, leading the way with charging rates that are, you know, unbelievable, 100, 150 kW per station, right? So you're looking at these power stations for Tesla and they got eight little power stations. That's a megawatt of power those guys got sitting there, right? So that's just Tesla definitely leading the way.
We had an amplifier on our airplane that had 200 kW in our airplane.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
So we can talk to submarines that are submerged on the other side of the world. You need that kind of 200 kilowatts of power. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So for a guy like you, you know, you need to look where those fast charges are. Can you stop every, you know, 4 or 5 hours, go out, use the restroom, get a bite to eat, plug in, get 80% of your charge in 20 or 30 minutes and then hit the next one, right? So for you, it's definitely long distance travel is definitely still challenging. Although now with a bunch of different programs that have come out, both from the VW settlement, if you remember that, there's been a charging
network set up. Oh, when they were lying? About all their stuff. Yeah. Well, so the Lightning guy, he showed me on the little, well, everyone's got like an iPad in their car now, right? So he showed me on the iPad that you pull up and it maps your route and it maps you the charging stations out exactly along the route, which is cool. It's a cool feature. But again, I'm a lazy guy. I'm not interested in the news. So I was like,
so for lazy guys, lazy guys that don't travel quite as much as you, but I will ask you a question, which is how often do you travel? But give you a sense, the statistic is that 98% of Americans' trips are less in a day are usually less than 100 miles, right? So I don't know about you. You're the exception. You go 800 miles in a day. I sometimes do, you know, a lot myself, but in most people, most of the time, we're going from here to the store, here to the school, here to work, whatever. You tally up your trip.
Absolutely. I was in San Diego this past weekend, which more than a day's drive, so I flew. But this weekend coming up, I'm going to be in Mobile. And Mobile is 11 and a half hour drive.
There you go.
That's easy.
For that one. Yeah.
Right? Yeah, absolutely.
So, but for most people, most of the time, and this is the part, if you happen to be a homeowner, you got a single family residence and you got an electric car, you plug it into your garage and overnight, even with a regular 110 socket, but if you got the same 220 volt that you use for your electric stove or your electric dryer, and you got that in your garage, you plug it into a 220 volt, it'll go a lot faster, and you'll get a lot more out of it faster. But the reality is, for most people, most of the time, you plug it in overnight, you forget about it, you come out, that's it. 98% of the time, you don't have to think about it. You go out, you come back, you do your thing, you plug it in, you forget about it. And it's, again, a half to 90% cheaper than paying for gasoline and no oil changes, no transmission fluid. And how convenient is that? You don't even have to stop to get gas. So talk about lazy. I love it, man. I plug it in at night. I forget about it. I don't have to worry about it. I come out, I do my stuff. I come back. I'm a lazy guy too. And it's a wonderful thing. So for most people, most of the time,
bringing them prices down, I'll be a happy camper.
Exactly. And those prices are coming down, which is the great thing, right? So just like, you know, our little smartphones, right? That, you know, 10 years ago were multiple millions of dollars. They took up a whole room or a floor of an office space. Same computer power. Now in this little silly iPhone or silly smartphone that we got in our pockets that now costs a few $100. That's the same thing that's happening with all these clean energy technologies. They're solid state. Solar prices coming down, heating, cooling prices coming down, and electric vehicle prices coming down as well. So, you know, you're right. Prices got to come down, and they are. And the great part, though, is that, you know, in addition to the prices coming down, they're close now. So with the tax credits that are out there, with utility and state incentives that are there, depending upon where you live, you can often get the incentives to the point where you're paying less for an electric car than you would be paying for a comparable fossil fuel gas vehicle. So take a look at the incentives, take a look at that. And then the other part again is take a look at your budget, right? And it's like, look, I'm spending $3,000 a year on gas. Jeepers. You mean I could spend less than I could save $2,000 a year just by switching over to electric, and I could just plug it into my house and not have to worry about going to a gas station. Okay. You know, worth thinking about, you know,
I'll pay a couple bucks extra. Total cost of ownership. Big deal.
Exactly.
Actually doing the math and doing the numbers. And you know what? I gotta be honest. I haven't done the math. I haven't done the numbers for my own personal usage. I've had vehicles that have been paid off for a couple of years, and obviously no car payment is way better than any car payment.
Absolutely.
So, but I wonder what it looks like. I wonder what the actual math would be by the time it comes up that I'm looking for my next vehicle.
Yeah, and depending upon how much you drive in, what your driving patterns are, and if you've got more than one vehicle, which I do too, same thing. So I got one car that's all electric. I got another that's a Chevy Volt, which goes 50 miles. My wife's car goes 50 miles on a charge, which is all she mostly needs during the day. But if we're going distance, we just take the Chevy Volt, and it's got gas as the secondary fuel. And now we get 100 miles to the gallon, which ain't bad. And, you know, we got gas, so we don't have to worry about it. We can go to a gas station wherever we are, right? So I don't have to do any planning. So, you know, there's different ways. But yeah, definitely take a look at the numbers. And if you're a nonprofit struggling with budgets, man, it definitely pays to take a look at your transportation budget and how you might be able to get that to be improved. Total cost of ownership, fuel cost, maintenance cost, and take a look. The numbers are really pretty incredible.
I tell you what, Ron, you make a pretty compelling argument for not only taking care of the planet, but also taking care of your budget at the same time.
Yeah. So here's, I got a nonprofit, right? So it's a great little school. It's one of my favorite clients, right? So they're the ones that I mentioned that did this. They had 3 acres that were just sitting there. They were fallow land. The kids used to go play in there a little bit. But basically they weren't using it at all. It was just a dumping ground, right? So they put the solar field there, gave them 100% of their electricity usage, which was great, right? But they also had extra now. So they were like, oh, we got all our energy coming from this solar field. You know, at some point they want to just buy it because they did this power purchase agreement. They didn't have capital, but they've been building up their capital supply. So they're going to buy it outright. When they buy it outright, they'll own it and they won't have to pay anything, which is great. These things are very low maintenance. There's almost nothing to do in terms of maintenance. So basically it's free energy, free electricity, right? Oh, you mean if we did heat pumps, air or ground source heat pumps, we could have that energy now supply our heating and cooling too? And oh, you mean if we took our 4 buses and we made those electric, we can have our solar system power that too? Wait a second. That's a significant impact on my budget every year. And now I got it covered, and I'm having a positive environmental impact all at the same time. And I'm using it as an educational tool for my kids, for the kids to learn about how solar works and electricity works and heating and cooling works and transportation works. And I do lessons with it in math. It was a pretty great win-win-win-win situation, which is why I love my job, Travis.
Well, there's no denying that. I don't think anyone can argue with you and say that you don't love your job. So I'm happy you're in that space, and I'm happy you can be my guest today. If people listening want to get a hold of you and find out more, what's the one place you want them to go?
Yeah, just go to earthkindenergy.com. Earthkind, like mankind, but earthkind, and energy, E-N-E-R-G-Y. So earthkindenergy.com. Lots of stuff there. There's a place to contact me that way if they want to email or call or just fill out a form. But earthkindenergy.com would be this simplest place. Lots of videos there, lots of educational materials, a bunch of different things. And if they got any questions or I can help them in any way, this is what I'm here for, guys. I love helping anybody really, but nonprofits in particular have a very soft space in my heart because you guys are all doing God's work, and God knows you can use all the help you can get and saving money with clean energy. That's win, win, win down the line. Boy, if I can help you in any way, I'd really love to. So thanks so much for having me on the show, Travis.
Hey, thanks a lot, Ron.
You've been listening to The Nonprofit Architect. To listen to all our past shows, visit http://nonprofitarchitect.org. And be sure to subscribe, rate, and review our show. Thank you.